fine-tuning problem. So so let me briefly explain the issue. So that, this is the Higgs potential in the standard model. It's not just the standard model which has problems. Right? they're very insistent. Okay. So this is the Higgs potential in the standard model. You minimize it, and you get the mass of the physical Higgs. And we can estimate the fine-tuning in the standard model by taking the ratio of the radiative corrections to the mass of the to the mass squared parameter in the potential. And we now know what the mass of the Higgs is. It's 125 GeV. So we can estimate the fine-tuning from the various contributions, right? So this is the top loop, the gauge loop, and the Higgs self-coupling. And the top loop is the biggest, and it tells you that the fine-tuning is worse than 10% unless this is cut off before about 1.5 TeV. The gauge loop is a bit better. The fine-tuning, it only has to be cut off at about 4 TeV. And the Higgs self-coupling becomes nasty above about 3 TeV. Okay, so the fine-tuning the standard model begins to become severe unless there's new physics around the TeV or so. And the biggest contribution to the Higgs mass is the radiative corrections to the Higgs mass are coming from the top loop. And so this is the biggest source of fine-tuning. And so we should expect something below about a TeV to cancel this loop. So whatever cancels it, you need some kind of a symmetry. And the top partners, which are the particles that we would think should be there to cancel this loop, you expect them to be related to the top quark by some kind of a symmetry. And for a long time, people thought that since the top quark carried color, the top partners would also be colored. And that's good news from the point of view of the LHC, because if you compare the cross sections for colored particles against the cross sections for uncolored particles, colored particles have much higher production cross sections. So the blue line is the production cross section for gluinos in in the MSSM. And the green lines are the production cross sections for the charginos and neutralinos in the MSSM. And so, you know, the gluinos are colored, the charginos are not. And you can see there's almost three orders of magnitude difference in the production cross sections, right? And so clearly, if the top partners are colored, discovery at the LHC will probably be much easier, right? And so this is the critical vertex, the coupling of the gluino to the top partners that, you know, that kind of dictates what the production cross section is going to be like. But some years ago, my collaborators and I showed that the top partners needn't actually be colored. And this generally happens in scenarios where the top and the top partners are related only by a discrete symmetry rather than by a continuous symmetry. And so we constructed at that time two examples, which were the first kinds of theories where this happened. So let me explain how this works. So crudely speaking, there have only been two classes of diagrams that have been found which cancel the top loop, okay? And these two classes are generalizations of the cancellations from supersymmetry and from little Higgs, okay? So there's the Suzy cancellation where you have scalars running in the loop, okay, that cancel the top loop. And then the top partners are scalars. And then there's a little Higgs cancellation where the cancellation happens with fermions in the loop. Okay? And all the cancellations that we know are related in one way or another to these cancellations. Okay? So let's think a little bit about why in these standard theories, right, the particles which cancel the loop are colored. Right? So let's think about supersymmetry for a minute. Okay? In supersymmetry, the scalar partners of the quarks are charged under color, and that's kind of obvious just from the Suzy transformations. So if you do a Suzy rotation, you rotate a quark into a skork, and this color index just goes along for the ride, right? Nothing happens to it when you do the Suzy transformation. So Suzy just commutes with the gauge interactions, right? And so if the top quark is colored, its superpartner is also automatically colored. And so in the case of supersymmetry, the top loop is canceled by particles which are colored. In Lil-Higgs, it's a little bit more complicated. Okay? In Lil-Higgs, what you're doing is you're embedding the theory, right? You're trying to get the Higgs as a protected goldstone of some bigger symmetry. And so let's see. So roughly speaking, the idea is something like this. So this is the usual standard model top Yukawa coupling, right? It's got so that's the left-handed top. This is the Higgs, and that's the right-handed top. And these are the quantum numbers under SU3 and SU2, right? So to get the Higgs as a goldstone, you have to embed this into some larger symmetry, right? So the simplest thing you can do is you can embed SU2 into SU3, and then to make this coupling invariant, it takes this form, and now notice there's an extra colored state in here, all right? Now when the bigger global symmetry is broken, the Higgs field in here becomes the goldstone, right? And to construct a little Higgs theory out of this, there's some extra structure that's required, right? But the point is that there's an extra state in here, which once you do that, becomes the top partner. And notice that just by the quantum numbers, it's automatically charged under color, right? And roughly speaking, the rule is that if the global symmetry is protecting the Higgs, like in this case, it was the bigger SU3 symmetry. If the bigger global symmetry is protecting the Higgs commute with color, then the top partners are also going to be colored. Okay? That's the rough rule of thumb. So let me give you a toy example where the top partners are not charged in the color. Okay? Okay. So imagine a theory where there are two copies of the top quark, A and B. And A carries charge under our regular QCD, and B carries charge under some hidden QCD, okay? Its own QCD. And there's an interchange symmetry between A and B and between QCD and this hidden QCD prime, right? And I'm going to do one more thing. I'm going to supersymmetrize this whole setup. So in this case, there's the usual top loop. Okay, so that's the Higgs, and it receives radiative corrections from the top. And this is canceled because of supersymmetry, okay, by the superpartners of the A particles. And there's also radiative corrections from the B quarks, and these are canceled by the scalars, the supersymmetric partners of B. Okay? So it's kind of like you've doubled the MSSM or something, okay, in the sense of at least for the quarks. All right? So this plus this is equal to zero, at least the quadratic divergences. And this plus this is equal to zero, okay? And there is an interchange symmetry between A and B. So this is equal to this, and this is equal to this, right? Now, because of all these symmetries, you can imagine, right, that since this is canceled by this, and this is equal to this, you can imagine that this is being canceled by that, and that's being canceled by this, right? Since the because of the symmetries involved. Okay.
TR12 have to be close to TR to the top.
Yeah, so right now this is still exactly supersymmetric. I haven't broken supersymmetry. That's true, but that's because right now this theory is exactly supersymmetric. I haven't even broken supersymmetry.
Well, we know the supersymmetry is
true. No, it's true, but I'm just kind of showing you.
It's a toy example, right?
Yeah, so in the end, the cancellation will persist. right? Now, now here's what I'm going to do. There's a consistent way to project out the scalars from A and the fermions from B using an orbifold. And so the remaining particles in the theory are the fermions from A and the scalars from B. And now these continue to cancel, okay, if you do this correctly using an orbifold, right? No, because at the next order, there are going to be contributions from gauginos and gluinos and things like that, okay? So this is a strictly a one-loop thing, okay? There may be ways to extend it, but then you will need a much more complicated orbifold. Okay, and I think that even then it will only work in the large end limit for adjoints. Here everything is in a fundamental. Okay, so SU3 does 8 gluons, right? So it would fail at the 1/n level, even at 2 loops. But right now I'm only going to talk about one loop. Okay, so project out the scalars from here, the fermions from there. So you can imagine that this cancellation continues to hold between this and this. And notice that these particles are not charged under our color. They're charged under their own internal color, right? So the cancellation still goes through, and this idea, because of what I call folded supersymmetry, which is one of the ideas we put out some years ago. So cancellation is now between this, the usual top loop, and these scalars, which are not charged under our color. So the idea is that this, as regards your question, provided these new scalars are not very heavy, the cancellation will still approximately go through, all right? So just like the usual MSSM, except that these guys are not charged under our color. They are charged under their own color. And so they cannot be produced through gluons the usual way. Okay, so, all right, so this worked. So this crucial vertex is now absent. So there's no strong production of top partners, right? But these particles still carry electroweak charges. And so they can still be produced, but at a much lower rate, right? And so the signal the signals will all be correspondingly suppressed, right?
Sir, do I understand this correctly that you don't actually have supersymmetry here, or I guess it's folded?
Yeah. So there's some. So the point is you began with a supersymmetry and a discrete symmetry. Mm-hmm. So you've projected out. You've projected out some of the states. So there's some residue of that original symmetry left. Okay. Now.
My question is that going to be, protected against further corrections? Like, you don't actually have the symmetry.
Yeah, so it's a good question. So that's why that's why I put that orbifold. It has to be done correctly. Okay. So we have an actual model where you can actually do it. Okay. And we have done it and we have computed everything. Okay? But yeah, most of the work in this project was actually constructing that orbifold and showing that it has the right properties. Okay, so when you actually construct the orbifold, it's an extra-dimensional theory, so everything is finite. So you can actually compute everything. Okay? Everything is cut off at the compactification scale, so you can explicitly verify this calculation. No, there isn't a real symmetry between the four-dimensional states, okay? So there isn't a discrete supersymmetry. Okay? So the point is the cancellation is happening because the low energy theory inherits some of the structure of the theory came down, okay? But as he very correctly pointed out, you have to be very, very careful that now you've got to be very, very sure that the cancellation continues to hold, right? And so, crudely speaking, the answer is it continues to hold if you orbifold it out consistently. So in other words, suppose you were to calculate suppose you were to do this in the 4D theory, you would find that this is cut off at lambda squared. There's a lambda squared here and there's a lambda squared here, right? And they come with opposite sign. Now, you know, usually in a SUSY textbook, they say, oh, this is positive, that's negative, they cancel, right? But that's nonsense. You need a Watt identity which enforces those two lambdas being the same, right? So and in this case, in the 4D theory by itself, you can't tell if those two lambdas are the same because you don't have that Watt identity, right? So you actually have to look at the full hierarchy setup with the orbifold and convince yourself that there is enough symmetry in the full theory to enforce this cancellation. Okay, so it's a valid question. It's very important. We thought about it, and we did the calculation, and so that's why we know it's true.
Yeah.
The decay rates for. I'm going to show you. Yeah. In fact, there's even a bound, so I'm going to show you. All right, so the cancellation of the top loop, the bottom line, takes place through a diagram of exactly the same form in supersymmetry. Major difference, the scale is running the loop. The top partners carry no charge under standard model color. So in this cancellation, the thing to notice is that color is just a multiplicative factor of 3 with no real significance, because none of these vertices here actually involve QCD. So what's really important for this cancellation is that the vertices in the diagrams are related in a specific way by symmetry. And the point is that the discrete A to B symmetry that is protecting the Higgs mass in this theory doesn't actually commute with standard model color. And that's the crucial difference between this kind of theory and the one and things like supersymmetry, which commute with color. So this class of theories protects the weak scale against radiative corrections up to about 5 to 10 TeV, which is the precision electroweak scale. And so there have been other theories of this type constructed. So you can roughly divide them into two classes. You have theories where you have partial neutral naturalness, in which the top partners carry electroweak charges, but not standard model color. So that's like the theory I talked about, folded supersymmetry. And another example is the quirky little Higgs, right? But you also have theories where you have complete neutral naturalness, where the top partners are neutral under all the standard model forces. So that was the original theory we wrote down, the mirror twin Higgs. And there's a more recent, more minimal realization called the fraternal twin Higgs. But all these theories only work up to about 5 to 10 TeV. And beyond that, some UV completion such as compositeness or supersymmetry is required to complete the solution of the hierarchy problem. But the point is that the physics of the UV completion may not be accessible to the LHC. So really, the physics that you study at the LHC really comes down to the physics of these low energy mechanisms that protect the Higgs mass. Okay. Right. The composite model, the existing composite models don't work very well. Okay. They all require tuning at the percent level or worse.
One other question. The reason we have trouble with this kind of model is because quarks are confined.
Yeah.
So what confines these objects?
Which objects?
The non-trouble.
They may not be confined.
Yeah.
Well, actually, let me be careful. In all these cases, in all these theories, there's a mirror color, right? But depending on the theory, for example, in the theory I just talked about, okay, so you have these mirror top partners, right? They carry their own, they transform on their own color group, right? But there are no light states charged under, these things are pretty heavy, these top partners. So there's no light states charged under this hidden color group. So the only light states in that sector are blue balls of this hidden color group. Okay. Well, you have to, it's not so easy to produce them directly. Okay, because you know, to talk to them, you have to, we don't talk to that color group directly. There's none of our standard model particles are charged under that color group. So, but it does lead to signals, as I'll show you. All right, now I want to talk a little bit about this one model of complete neutral naturalness, okay? I want to give you the basic idea. So, so this is the twin Higgs model. So the idea is that there's a scalar field which transforms as a fundamental under a global U4. And so at the renormalizable level, this would be the kind of potential you can write down, a kind of Mexican hat form. And this Higgs would get a web, right, which I'll call F. Right. And this U4 symmetry is broken to U3, giving rise to seven Goldstones. Right. But just like in the standard model, this potential actually has a bigger symmetry, accidental symmetry, which is O8, right? Because there are eight real fields in there are eight real fields here. And if you expand this out, you can see that this has an accidental O8 symmetry, which is broken to O7. And you can think of the seven Goldstones as either coming from O8 to O7 or from U4 to U3. It doesn't really make much of a difference at this point, right? Now imagine that you gauge an SU2 cross SU2 subgroup of this bigger symmetry, right? And eventually we'll identify SU2A with SU2 left of the standard model. And SU2B will correspond to what we call a twin SU2, right? So under the gauge symmetry, you can decompose H into a doublet of our SU2, which is SU2A, and a doublet under the other SU2, right? And this doublet will eventually be identified with our Higgs, and the other state will be what we call the twin Higgs, right? Now that there are actually interactions in the gauge interactions in the theory, they're gonna be radiative corrections to the Higgs potential. And they're going to give rise to quadratic divergences. And so this is just like the usual standard model story, right? But with an extra HA and HB, right? With an extra HB. But here's the idea. Impose a Z2 symmetry which interchanges A and B so that GA is equal to GB is equal to G, right? So then this thing reduces to some term like this. And notice that this thing over here is just H dagger H, right? And so it's completely U4 invariant. And so you can completely absorb it into the mass term in the potential. And so it can't give a mass to the Goldstones, right? So as a consequence of the discrete symmetry, the quadratic terms in the Higgs potential respect a bigger global symmetry. And so even though the gauge interactions constitute a hard breaking of the symmetry, the Goldstones are prevented from acquiring a quadratically divergent mass, right? And you can see this cancellation. So I showed you the cancellation. I argued that the quadratic divergences vanish in this very simple linear model. But let me show you that it happens more generally. So consider the case where the symmetry breaking is realized non-linearly. And if I can show you that that happens in this case, that will prove that independent of UV completion, okay, this cancellation will happen, right? Okay, so it turns out that, you know, for the general case, you need O8, okay, to keep custodial SU2, but I'm only gonna keep the SU4 subgroup of O8 manifest, right? So then parameterize the Goldstones in terms of these nonlinear fields, of these fields H which transform nonlinearly. And the first two components of H are the standard model Higgs. And since this is a nonlinear theory, it has a cutoff, which is gonna be less than 4 pi f. And so in general, one can write all operators suppressed by this cutoff consistent with this bigger global symmetry, right? So, okay, so now let's see how the quadratic divergences cancel. So this is the simplest operator which will give you something like a top you cover and expand it out in terms of the little h's. And you get something that looks just like the usual top you cover coupling, but you get this funny non-renormalizable interaction between the Higgses and the the mirror quarks, right? And so if you actually calculate the quadratic divergences, you get the usual top loop. But this funny non-renormalizable term, it leads to an interaction. It leads to a loop diagram. And in this diagram, the top you cover appears twice here and here. But here it also appears twice because there's a top you cover here from this word sitting out front here. And you need the top you cover for this chirality flip, which is coming from this. And so when you compute it, the quadratic divergences cancel exactly. And the diagrams have the same form as in the Lille-Higgs theory. And so now what I'm showing you here is that the states which cancel the top loop need not be colored. And in fact, they need not even carry electroweak charge, all right? And you can prove that this cancellation works to, so I'm showing you the one loop graph, but it's a nonlinear theory, and it's, you might wonder, well, maybe at higher orders, the quadratic divergences are regenerated. You can generalize this to all loops using a spurion analysis. The cancellation of gauge loops also takes the same form as in Lille-Higgs. You can once again find there's a vertex of this form. So this is the usual standard model loop. And turns out to be another loop that involves the Higgs coupling to the twin gauge bosons, right? And this comes with a minus sign, and the quadratic divergences cancel. But this turns out to be more complicated because there are higher dimensional terms like this, which also contain gauge interactions, and which can potentially contribute to the Higgs mass at one loop. And so at least in the case when you have a strongly coupled UV completion, it needs a pretty careful analysis to prove this. And what we showed is that if the symmetry breaking pattern is 08 to 07, the cancellation does go through, right? So we showed this some years ago, and there was a more recent analysis by these guys which found the same result. Okay, so once you have done this, the remaining contributions to the Higgs potential are only log divergent. And so for a cutoff of 5 TeV, the Higgs mass is of order the weak scale. Now there's a vacuum alignment issue. We want an electroweak VEV to be less than F. To do that, we add a term which softly breaks the symmetry. It doesn't reintroduce quadratic divergences. And it's technically natural, right? So now the thing to do is to extend this discrete symmetry to all the interactions of the standard model, right? And the simplest possibility is to identify the discrete symmetry with parity. Okay. So one way to do it is to associate parity with left-right symmetry, but that's not the approach I'm going to take today. So I'm going to focus on this mirror twin Higgs model, in which there's a mirror copy of the standard model with exactly the same field content and interactions. So what the parity symmetry is doing is it's interchanging every standard model field with the corresponding field in the mirror standard model. Although the mirror fields are light, they haven't been observed because they are not charged under the standard model gauge groups. Okay, so now this is a theory where there are many, many light states. We don't see them because they don't transform under our gauge groups. So a long time ago, people realized that if you have a mirror standard model, there's only two renormalizable couplings you can write down. One is this coupling between the Higgses. Okay? And this is already there in our theory because it's part of the Higgs quartic. And the other is photon mirror photon mixing. Right? This is very tightly constrained by experiment. I'm going to set it to zero, and it can show that it's not radiatively generated until very, very high loop order.
Do you have an exact copy of the standard model?
Right now, I have an exact copy of the standard model. Okay, the mass. Yeah, right now it's actually exact. Okay, mass for mass, every single thing. Right.
And they don't unify. Do they unify it before at the 5 to 10 TeV, or is it just that?
No, it's still separate. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so then the standard model communicates with the mirror world only through the Higgs portal, right? Very difficult, obviously, to test, right? after electroweak breaking, this Stanwell Higgs and the twin Higgs mix. And this leads to corrections to Higgs physics, and this is what a large part of the rest of the talk is going to be about. But the tightest constraints in this class of theories come from the cosmological bounds on dark radiation. Right? So what the Higgs-Podol interaction does is it keeps the mirror sector in thermal equilibrium with the standard model until temperatures of a few GeV. And that's bad because there are bounds on dark radiation. So the way to get around this bound is to require that between this few GeV and about 5 MeV, even the weak interactions decouple, some entropy is added to the standard model sector, but not to the mirror sector. And there's ways to do this. None of them are pretty, but it's possible. Right?
Can I ask? Mm-hmm. I don't understand in this scenario how you actually solve a hierarchy problem, how you protect the Higgs maximum. Because I mean, you just have this coupling
right
between the two Higgs, so how protect the Higgs mass?
So, the point is that this coupling is part of the U4 symmetric quartic. Okay? And so, why do I say this?
So it's like, this is how it's protected.
Okay, so look at this potential,
yeah.
Right? You agree that in this thing, there is a massless state.
Yes,
right? Notice that this contains that HA squared HB squared term when you expand this thing out, right? Mm-hmm. It's got a coefficient which is exactly 2 times this lambda, mm-hmm. Right? So the way a Goldstone mechanism works is that the mass term gives a contribution to the mass that's cancelled by the VeV of this thing on that side. So the point is to keep that cancellation radiatively stable. Okay, and that's what this mechanism does.
And you're saying that the U4 symmetry does that job.
Yeah, that's right. So it maintains the necessary equality between the mass term and this web. Okay. All right. So after some years after we wrote this paper, in fact, fairly recently, a year or two back, there was a more minimal realization of this idea, in which below 5 TeV, the only light states kept in the theory are those essential for naturalness or theoretical consistency, right? So really to protect the theory to 5 TeV, you only need the third generation fermions, the SU2 gauge bosons, and the mirror color, right? These are the only things you absolutely need for naturalness. So in this theory, they keep only these states, right? And now notice there are no light quarks in the charged under mirror QCD. So the lightest hadrons in the mirror sector in this theory are glue balls. Unlike in the original mirror twin Higgs, where you have pions, right? And these glue balls, as I'm going to show you in a minute, can be accessed through the Higgs portal and give rise to exotic phenomenology, right? So the cosmological constraints are also more easily satisfied.
Okay.
So the dark radiation bounds are much less severe. And there are also pretty decent dark matter candidates in the mirror B and tau. And I think one of the authors is here.
Yeah.
I promise, I didn't know that when I wrote that slide, okay? All right. So now the question, how do you test these theories at colliders? So roughly speaking, there are three sets of ideas that people have come up with. So one is precision Higgs studies, right? So by definition, so you're solving the hierarchy problem is basically a problem of the Higgs sector, right? So whatever solves it must have big couplings to the Higgs. And so that can affect the properties of the Higgs. And this is true of every model of this type. Every model of this type can, in principle, be probed by looking at its effects on Higgs physics. All right? Then, mirror QCD is a characteristic feature of this theory, these theories. And so in the theories where the states in the hidden in this hidden sector are the mirror blue balls, turns out the Higgs can decay into them, and then these things are not stable. They can decay back to standard model particles, giving rise to displaced vertices. Now, the thing is that this doesn't apply to all the theories. For example, it doesn't apply to the mirror twin Higgs, right? But it applies to many theories of this type. So this is another way to probe these theories. And lastly, if the top partners carry electroweak charge, you can directly produce them at colliders. And the decay products may involve standard model particles. And this is, and once again, this is a good way to probe these theories. In fact, roughly speaking, but I should mention this only applies if the top partners carry electroweak charge. So it doesn't apply to either the mirror or the fraternal twin Higgs. So roughly speaking, what we're going to see is that this is the best way to probe these theories. This is pretty good, and that's not so good. Okay, but notice that as we go this way, we lose theories. Okay, there are most all theories can be probed this way. Some can be probed this way, and the fewest can be probed here. Okay? So, all right. So just the way it works out. All right. So let's look at precision Higgs. So after electroweak symmetry breaking, the Higgs and the twin Higgs mix, the Higgs production cross-section is suppressed by the mixing angle, right? And so that's going to affect the Higgs production. At the same time, the mixing means that sometimes the Higgs can decay into invisible states, right? So both these effects mean that you're going to see less Higgs events than you would have in the standard model, right? Both effects go in the same direction, and they reduce the number of Higgs events that we see. Okay? At the same time, you know, you can directly search for invisible Higgs decays at the LHC, right? Look for a Z recoiling against nothing, for example. Okay, because we can directly search for invisible Higgs or VBF, right? In VBF, you can search for invisible Higgs decays, and so. It turns out that in the mirror twin Higgs model, there's a single mixing angle which tells you both the, which controls both the suppression in Higgs rate and the fraction of invisible Higgs decays. So there's a prediction for the ratio of this and this, okay, which is not that common in. Now there's many theories where you get a suppression of the Higgs production rate, and there's many theories where you get invisible Higgs decays. But there's relative, I don't know of any other theory where these two are correlated. Okay, and the reason they are correlated is because the bottom Yukawa is the same in the standard model and the twin sector. Okay, so that's why there's a correlation between these things, right? And so that means there's actually a prediction in this theory, right? If you could do this, right? Okay, so what's the scenario at present? What's the situation today? Okay, so today the cross section is known, the Higgs production cross section is known to be within about 20% of the standard model, right? Now, what in this plot, what I've shown is the top partner mass, and this is the number of Higgs events taken as a ratio of the event rate in the standard model. So this is the fraction of Higgs events compared to the standard model. So 1 corresponds to the standard model, and 0.8 means there's a 20% suppression, and so on, right? So if we know the cross-section to 20% of the standard model, that means that we are sitting here at 0.8. You pull it out, and let's see. Okay, so yeah, it comes out to about a little less than 500 GeV, right? So the bound on the top partner masses today is about 500 GeV, so it's not a very tight bound, right? It's much less than a TeV, right? Now, the limit is only expected to improve to about 10%. So now that's 10% over there, extrapolated out. So it's getting to about 600 or 700 GeV, right? And so it's still going to be less than a TeV, right? Which means that top partners of 800, 900 GeV will probably still be allowed at the, by the end of the LHC run. So the bottom line is that probably the LHC will not be able to conclusively disfavor naturalness. Okay, top partners with masses less than a TeV will still be allowed, right? And so to probe this kind of a theory, some kind of a linear collider may be required, because that would be able to probe the Higgs width, you know, it would be able to measure invisible Higgs widths down to a percent. And then this theory would be, you'd be for the top partner masses would be pushed into the multi TeV range. Well, the thing is that only takes into account you can't compute the full push electroweak because there's contributions from the UV completion, right? So this is only the positional electroweak from the light states, okay? So those bounds are, you know, they look strong, but you've got to remember there's a comparable contribution from the UV that you don't know, okay? So from that perspective, they're not that strong. So in other words, if the cutoff is really 5 TeV, then the cutoff is strongly coupled pretty much, right? And so then by definition, those contributions are big. Okay, they are basically comparable to these, right? And so that's why those bonds are, you know, they can't be taken that seriously. Right, but that's a 50, that's a, what you may call a, it could go either this way or that way, and we don't know, right? No, what I'm saying is parametrically, those contributions are not smaller. Yeah. Okay, that's what I mean. Parametrically, those contributions are not smaller. Okay, so in folded supersymmetry, the Higgs production doesn't change very much, right? But now, because the top partners carry electroweak charge, there are now new diagrams that contribute to Higgs to gamma-gamma, right? And so we can look at the Higgs to gamma-gamma rate and see how and see what that looks like. But it turns out the current LHC limits from this are not good. Okay? The limits are weak, and they're not expected to improve very much. So right now, we maybe know Higgs to gamma-gamma may, you know, at best at the maybe the 10%, within 10% of the standard model. And these lines show three different versions of folded supersymmetry, but with different values of the A parameter that mixes the stops. And you can see they very quickly go towards the standard model value once the top partner mass is above about 350 GeV, right? So again, the bounds here are not that good, right? At least from Higgs physics, right? Turns out that, so there's a paper by the Chicago group which says that positional electroweak measurements at a lepton collider would be able to constrain this scenario better. Okay. But right now, this particular, the Higgs is not a particularly good probe of this theory. Now in the quirky little Higgs, there is a net reduction in Higgs events from mixing, just like in the twin Higgs. But there's also a correction to the Higgs decay to gamma-gamma because the top partners carry electroweak charge. Now, the red dotted line is Higgs to gamma-gamma. The blue solid line is the suppression in the Higgs rate. And it's this Higgs rate which gives the stronger bound. But once again, when you actually look at it, the bound on the top partner mass is only about 350 GeV today. And again, this will not improve that much. Okay? So it will improve to maybe 500, 600 GeV, but it'll still be less than a TeV. Okay? So the situation with regard to just Higgs physics is that it's a useful probe of the mirror twin Higgs model. It will give bounds to about eventually to about maybe 600, 700 GeV, maybe even 800 GeV, but not all the way to a TeV. And for the other theories, it's not a particularly good probe.
Sorry, why is what is question about the TEV. Why do you say?
Because the top partners have to be lighter than a TEV for the tuning to be less than about 10% or something.
Okay.
That's the beginning of the talk, right?
So 10% is like the magic number.
For yeah, roughly speaking, yeah. Yeah, okay, that's arbitrary. Okay. All right, so now let's come to a different probe of these theories, which is exotic HDKs. Right? So in many of these theories, the mirror QCD sector has no light quarks, only gluons, right? And then the lightest hadrons in this sector are glue balls, right? So what can happen is the Higgs can decay, just like the Higgs can decay into two gluons in the standard model. It can also decay to two mirror gluons. And these mirror gluons, when they hadronize, will give glue balls. So you can hear this is the Higgs. It couples to the top partners. The top partners can decay into two gluons, and then these become glue balls, right? Now, the idea is that the 0++ glue balls through the top partners actually mix with the Higgs, and they can therefore decay back to the standard model through an off-shell Higgs. Now, the spectrum of glue ball states, okay, the spectrum of glue ball states, and some of the relevant matrix elements are known from the lattice. Okay? So this is a plot from a lattice paper, right? And this allows an estimate. Okay, this allows an estimate of the glue ball lifetime, right? Now, these guys showed that for most of the parameter range of interest, the decays of the lightest glue ball, the 0++ glue ball, is slow on collider time scales. And so you get displaced vertices. Okay? And since this is a very striking signature, it's a very powerful probe of these theories. So this is actually not my work. It's the work of a Maryland postdoc and my grad student, Chris Verharen. Right? So the LHC can use these exotic Higgs decays to place pretty powerful limits on this scenario. Okay? And so what this plot shows is the glue ball mass here, and this is on the vertical axis is the mass of the top partners, right? So this is on this side is the mass of the top partner in the fraternal twin Higgs, and this is in the case of folded SUSY, right? And the shaded regions are the places where you have sensitivity. Now, depending on the glue ball mass, that controls the decay width. And so the lifetime of the glue ball depends on its mass. And so you need different searches for different ranges of the glue ball mass, right? And so for example, this region corresponds to the two displaced decays in the muon system, or one displaced decay in the muon system and one in the inner tracker, and so on. So there are several different, so depending on the glue ball mass, the search has to be customized, right? And some of these searches were not being done when this paper was written, but now they are. But now it looks like they are all going to be done. Okay, the experiments have agreed to do these searches. And the point is that in most of parameter space, you have reach out to about one TeV top partner masses. So you can see up to about one TeV top partner masses you have reach. And for the theories that you can probe this way, this is often the most effective probe of these theories. Okay? And since you can go all the way out to one TeV, the limits may eventually be comparable to the bounds on the colored top partners. Okay, so lastly, let me come to the case where you directly produce top partners. So if the top partners carry electroweak charges, they can be pair produced at the LHC. And the thing that makes this peculiar is that since these things carry color charge, right, they're not color singlets, they can't decay to standard model particles, right? Because the standard model particles are all neutral under color, right? So what happens is that they can't fly apart. They are connected by a string of QCD prime, And, you know, so they're kind of held together. And since there are no light states charged under QCD prime, this string can't break the way it does in the standard model, right? So what happens is they remain connected by this string, which binds them, and this is kind of an excited state that de-excites through the emissions of photons and hidden glue balls, right? So eventually, once this reaches a low enough state, these particles pair annihilate, resulting in final states that can be detected. Okay? And even though this is an extended object, it turns out it de-excites quickly. And so it's actually prompt on collider timescales, right? But the point is, you often get final states that can be detected, right? So in folded supersymmetry, you can produce a top and bottom through the W. They pair annihilate back into the standard model. And it turns out that the primary annihilation channel, so this shows you the branching ratio into various channels. The primary annihilation channel is to W plus gamma, right? And so the signal is a bump in this channel, right? Now it turns out there's an Atlas search which looks for precisely for a bump in this channel. And they didn't see anything, and we can use that to place limits on the masses of the top partners, right? So right now, if you the bound is at around 350 GeV, okay, and which is not very strong, but of course, with the 14 TeV machine, you have there's much more reach, and this is expected to improve quite a bit. It may eventually reach up to 700 or 800 GeV. I'm not sure, but it'll reach up there, maybe even close to a TV. But there's another way you could produce the top partners. You could produce the top partners through the Z, right? And now the thing about the previous thing, when you produce a top and bottom partner, right? The thing is the top and bottom partner have electric charge. So you have to have at least one particle in the final state which has electric charge. When you produce a pair of top partners, they have no net electric charge. And so in principle, they could go to just to purely hidden states. Okay, they could go to a pair of hidden gluons. Okay, so you could get jets. So you could get jets of basically hidden glue balls. But remember, these glue balls could decay back to the standard model, right? Some of them, the 0++ ones, can decay back to the standard model with displaced vertices. So you could get this very striking signal of emergent jets, right? So these glue balls are produced, they are streaming out, and then some of them decay to standard model BB bar pairs. And so so you get displaced vertices with BB bar pairs, but more than one of them, and they seem to be kind of confined within some kind of a jet cone, right? So very striking signal. And there are other annihilation channels like WW, ZZ, and Dihiggs. They're not as striking, but if you should ever see this in this hidden glue ball channel, it would be very good for precision studies of the top partners. You could measure their masses and things very precisely. Now, so this, of course, only applies to theories where you can produce the top partners in electroweak channel, right? So for the quirky little Higgs, this actually leads to probably the most promising signal in most of parameter space. So what I did is I took the previous plot, which was for the invisible Higgs decays, and I've overlaid it with these green lines. And these green lines, what they are showing is the number of glue ball events from direct production versus the number of glue ball events from Higgs production. Okay. So where the number on the green line is more than one, direct top product part of production wins. And where the number is less than one, Higgs production wins. And so you can see there's a pretty big region of parameter space where the green lines are more than one. And in fact, the line where they're equal to one is up at about a TV, which means that this is a way to probe these top partners with masses up to about a TeV. Right? And this plot is actually for quirky little Higgs, but it turns out that for folded supersymmetry as well, this is also the most promising signal in a good chunk of parameter space. Okay, so let me conclude. So solutions to the hierarchy problem based on symmetry may only involve particles that are neutral under some, and perhaps even all of the forces in the standard model. The experimental signals of such a scenario tend to be very different from conventional solutions to the hierarchy problem. It motivates many new searches involving displaced vortices. And I think the good news is that, you know, compared to when this work began, is that many of these searches are actually being done. Okay? One thing to take away is the LHC will probably not be able to conclusively exclude symmetry-based solutions to the hierarchy problem, because there are realizations of these ideas that don't involve any of these particularly striking signals. Thank you. Yeah.
So in the models where you don't have a first family, this is hard breaking of the symmetry, right?
Right.
So then how do you ensure that the gauge couplings are the same, or
so then you have to look at a UV completion, right? So the one UV completion that I know about that kind of makes sense is the thing that Nathaniel and collaborators put out not too long ago. I think so, yeah. So the idea is that you do something like RS, right, where in the bulk you have all three families, right? But then on the IR brain, you orbifold them away. So so the idea is that on the IR brain, you just have the third generation. So the other guys have satisfy odd boundary conditions. Right?
The point is that
brain localized operators can break it. Right?
Yes. Exactly.
But the point is that if you have a, you know, if the bulk dominates. Yeah, then you win, right? So to that extent, it's okay. So then it becomes a detailed question, right? So I'm assuming these guys have done it correctly, okay? But I don't see in principle that it can't work. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah.
So the bottom line seems to be that in order to solve the Nash's problem, lambda squared, you have to put in particles into the loops.
All right.
Because you do this by putting in particles that are difficult to detect.
Right.
Some people might consider this unnatural.
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, it's not. Let me put it this way. It's not like it's easy to find a solution to the hierarchy problem. Okay. So there has to be a symmetry, and it's very hard to find the symmetry will give you the couplings you need, right? And so so one has to explore, you know, there's not an infinite number of possibilities, there's a very limited set, right? As far as we know. And so we should explore all of them, right? And it turns out that, you know, as far as I can tell, the data so far seems to agree with what I've just shown you. Okay. There is no evidence of supersymmetry or composite Higgs. So
no evidence of fourth generation. Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the data if there is a solution to the hierarchy problem along these lines, it seems it has to look something like this.
So if the standard model is flawed, the question is why?
So will the Hamilton TV collider definitely test this?
That's a very interesting question. So the question is really, and people are beginning to talk about this, the question is really whether a 100 TV machine will be able to conclusively exclude all symmetry-based solutions to the hierarchy problem. Nobody knows the answer for sure, right? But people are beginning to discuss it. So right now, the way it looks, so right now, here's the situation. Every theory that I showed you can be probed using a 100 TeV machine. Using so let's say we go the FCC route. So you have first a Higgs factory, and then you use the same tunnel to build a 100 TeV hadron machine. Every theory I showed you would be excluded at the 1% level, or worse if you did that, okay, and you didn't see anything. But then you can ask the question, using these ideas, is it possible to build a theory that would survive those machines, right? And that's a hypothetical, because now, you know, it's not like there exists such a theory that somebody's written down. It becomes a hypothetical. What, in principle, what could be done? From a model building perspective, what could be done, okay? So the roughly speaking, the idea, right? Roughly speaking, the conclusion, and there's a paper on this by our Maryland postdocs, David Curtin and Prashant Saraswat, and that, I think that's the only paper on this general question. The conclusion seems to be that you would be able to probe this general class of symmetry-based solutions at the 10% level. Okay, so all these theories are the 1% level, but you know, you could imagine a theory which is so difficult to probe that you can only probe it at the 10% level, even with a 100 TeV machine. Okay. But okay. Yeah.
Does run-one triggers have any sensitivity to some of these displaced jet
submissions? I don't know. What I do know is that I think only one of those searches was actually being done. I think only one of these searches was actually being done in round one. I don't know enough about what their triggers were to know whether now you can go back and look and see if they can be reanalyzed. I don't know about that. Yeah.
Maybe we can wrap up, but you're here until 5 today.
Yeah.
So any last questions people can sort of filter out and finish questions. Thank you.